Welcome to Corp Watch Radio, your weekly review of corporate news. This week, we'll interview Lotte Carson about how the Danish shipping giant Maersk took control of an Iraqi port and why they eventually got driven out. But first, for the week of January 30th through February 5th, I'm Sakura Saunders.
And I'm Stephen Valentino.
And these are the Corp Watch headlines.
Over 100,000 activists from around the world gathered last Tuesday in Caracas, Venezuela for the 6th World Social Forum. This year's World Social Forum is polycentric, and parallel social forums are being held in Bamako, Mali, and Karachi, Pakistan, with the Bamako World Social Forum finishing just this last week. Indigenous protesters from northwestern Venezuela marched Friday through the streets of Caracas to protest plans for coal mining on their land. The roughly 150 indigenous protesters donned their traditional dress with bows, arrows, and drums, and were accompanied by some 2,000 representatives of Venezuelan and South American environmental and leftist groups. They represent around 300,000 indigenous people in a country of 26.5 million. The protest aimed to press Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to halt the mining project and formally award the land to the indigenous people who currently rely on it for their livelihoods. Venezuela's Carbuzilia Coal and Brazilian state-owned Companhia Vale do Rio Doce have already formed a consortium to mine coal in the region.
Executives at New Orleans-based Freeport-McMoRan Copper and Gold publicly acknowledge that the mining company is now under scrutiny by the U.S. government for payments made to the Indonesian military. These payments were made to secure their mining operations in Papua, where they operate the world's largest gold mine. This attention is a response to an investigation by the New York Times, which found that Freeport had given nearly $20 million to individual military and police officials, including military units criticized by the U.S. State Department for human rights violations. Freeport is also known to have made payments to Indonesia's former dictator, President Suharto, for the right to do business in Papua, a province whose internal politics includes a largely indigenous movement for independence from Indonesia. Freeport has dismissed these charges as, quote, ordinary business activities, citing the need for a secure work environment for its more than 18,000 employees. Meanwhile, the company has declined to comment on its surveillance program, which monitors the email messages and phone conversations of its employees with suspected environmental opponents. Freeport's Papua mine creates 700,000 tons of waste a day. This waste produces acid runoff, which pollutes the groundwater. In addition, the mining tailings dumped in the river have killed all life there, according to an internal ministry memorandum published in the year 2000. Freeport shares fell over 2% after the executives made their announcement, despite the fact that their fourth quarter profits had more than doubled on account of the rising price of gold.
On Monday, Nigerian militants released four foreign oil workers who had been kidnapped 17 days earlier in an attack on the EA offshore oil field of energy giant Shell. Their kidnapping was one in a series of attacks, which included the bombing of a major oil pipeline and an armored attack which took the lives of at least 17 troops and an unknown number of militants. The attacks, which were claimed by the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, or MEND, led Shell to evacuate over 300 workers and cut Nigerian oil output by a tenth. The group said it would release the hostages on the condition that the government freed two detained leaders of the ethnic Ija group. The hostages were released without this condition being met, in what men called a goodwill gesture to the international community. The militants had also demanded more local control over the Delta's oil wealth and compensation for oil pollution to villages in the vast wetlands region. The Ija are the biggest ethnic group in the Delta. On Sunday, before the release of the hostages, police reported that gunmen raided the compound used by South Korea's Daewoo Oil Company in Nigeria's Restive South, fleeing in speedboats with nearly $300,000 in cash. Just 6 days prior, militants had raided the offices of Italian oil company Agip, killing 9 persons, 8 of them police officers, before fleeing with about $28,000. It is not clear yet if these thefts had any connection to the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, and at least in the Daewoo case, police suspect an inside job. Everybody run, run, run. Everybody scatter, scatter. Some people lost some bread. Someone nearly died. Someone just died. Police, they come, army, they come. Confusion everywhere. Nigeria has the world's seventh largest proven reserves of natural gas and is the fifth largest provider of crude oil to the United States.
ExxonMobil, the world's largest publicly traded oil company, Monday reported a quarterly profit of $10.7 billion, capping a year of record earnings dominated by surging oil and gas prices. This is made for an overall 42% rise in profit from 2004. Recently, the company and its peers have come under pressure for posting billions in profits while consumers are struggling with high gasoline prices. In addition, according to a New York Times report printed last week, the federal government is receiving little more money in royalty payments from companies that are extracting oil from publicly owned land. This report asserts that if royalty payments for natural gas had risen in step with market prices, the government would have received about $700 million more than it actually did. As a result, U.S. taxpayers, who collectively are the largest holder of American oil and gas reserves, seem to be the only ones left out of the energy profits.
The trial of Kenneth Lay and Jeffrey Skilling, the one-time leaders of Enron, begins this week. It promises to be one of the most closely watched and hotly contested white-collar criminal cases ever brought by the United States Justice Department. In many ways, it is fitting for the story of Enron to end with a trial that is widely viewed as a verdict on the business practices of the late 90s. When it was flying high, the energy giant was celebrated from boardrooms to business schools alike. But with its collapse into bankruptcy in 2001, costing investors billions and pushing thousands of employees out onto the street, it became emblematic of everything wrong in corporate America. The defense case will focus on the requirements and dictates of accounting and securities rules. These include Enron's use of Byzantine off-books partnerships that helped pretty up the company's balance sheet and improve its income statement. A crucial witness in the government's case is Andrew Fasto, the former Enron chief financial officer who has pleaded guilty and is cooperating with the prosecution. Fasto began committing crimes through the use of off-the-books entities for personal enrichment. In one deal called Radar, Mr. Fasto funneled money to various investors who then returned profits to him. In another called Chuco, Fasto allowed a close colleague, Michael Cooper, to control the investment, then accepted kickbacks on the deal. The big question that a jury will have to decide is, did Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling know about this fraud?
Last Monday's arrest of Japanese internet entrepreneur Takafumi Hori resembles an Enron-like crisis for the world's second-largest economy. Hori and three other Livedoor executives were arrested on suspicion of spreading false information to pump up the value of their stock. After the prosecutor's raid on the company, a push to sell Livedoor shares overwhelmed the Tokyo Stock Exchange to the point that it was forced to halt trading early for the first time in history. After a week, the company's stock value was taken down by 80% of its original value. It was a steep fall for Hori, who at 33 had the ambition to make his internet-based conglomerate the world's largest company. A surreal turn of events for a man who just last August had been selected by Prime Minister Koizumi to run against the governing party for parliament. However, perhaps the largest shock was to the faith in Japanese corporate governance, which has traditionally relied on the self-regulation of companies and requires little in the way of disclosure. You're listening to Corp Watch Radio. For more information about any of these stories, go to www.corpwatch.org.
Last Monday, the United Nations presented a confidential report to several governments admitting to more mismanagement and corruption in their international peacekeeping operations. This revelation comes in the heels of an investigation which revealed massive corruption and sexual abuse in the UN's now-defunct Oil for Food program. Out of the 4,758 companies participating in the program, 2,260, or 47% of the participating companies, paid kickbacks to former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. In an attempt to root out corruption, the UN last month enacted a new whistleblower protection policy. The UN is now investigating 200 different reports of abuse, with eight officials already placed on special leave with pay. The abuses under investigation include $65 million in unnecessary fuel contracts in Sudan and Haiti, and an overpayment of $9.8 million for the lease of a helicopter in East Timor. Christopher Burnham, the UN Undersecretary General for Management and Administration, estimates the abuse in the tens of millions of dollars, while U.S. Ambassador John Bolton has made claims that $300 million of the $1 billion in contracts under investigation has been wasted. The UN has indicated that it will release this report after its lawyers have deleted the names of the companies and individuals suspected of wrongdoing.
Last Tuesday, the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction released a new audit of U.S. financial practices in Iraq. This report has uncovered irregularities that point to theft and mismanagement with reconstruction funds, most of which have come from Iraqi oil proceeds and cash seized from Saddam Hussein's government. Agents from the Inspector General's office found many shrink-wrapped bricks of $100 bills in living and working quarters of American occupation officials, including 2 million kept in a bathroom safe and a 500,000 in an unlocked footlocker. The report also pointed to poorly supervised reconstruction projects. One, a swimming pool refurbishing project, was signed off as completed after the contractor was paid over $100,000 for polishing hardware that was supposed to be replaced. Another, a contract for more than $600,000 to rehabilitate a general hospital in the southern city of Hila. Here, instead of replacing a central elevator bank, as was called for, it was improperly repaired, leading to the death of three Iraqis when the elevator crashed.
The news website RawStory.com reported Tuesday that a senior fraud investigator for the Pentagon, who had crusaded against military contractor overcharges for 7 years, has been suspended for insubordination. This, according to an article written by Eric Rosenberg for the Hearst News Service. Raw Story reports that Rosenberg's article, which went out to Hearst member papers, has not appeared in any of them, nor has any story been published by the mainstream press about his suspension. Kenneth Petelos, an industrial engineer for the Defense Contract Management Agency, told Hearst that his 30-day suspension was absolutely related to his whistleblowing. In 2002, Petelos authored a 90-page report titled Criminal Vulnerability and Fraud, which accused Lockheed Martin of willfully overcharging the Pentagon and defense officials of ignoring his warnings. This report led Senate Finance Committee Chairman Charles Grassley to persuade the Department of Defense's Inspector General offices to launch investigations. Petelos told the Federal Times in 2004 that he believed he ruined his career and lost any chance for promotion because of his fight.
In other news involving military contractors, recent reports point to a complex system of trafficking arising out of a mess of subcontractors and recruiters, which have led unsuspecting laborers from India, Nepal, and the Philippines to U.S. military bases in Iraq. Here, they do tasks once performed by the U.S. military and now outsourced to Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Once in Iraq, reports indicate that it is common practice for these third country nationals to have their passports confiscated, their overtime denied, and at times they even lack adequate food and water. Last Friday at a protest, 30 youth from Punjab, India, threatened self-immolation if the government failed to book their traffickers and return their money. These youth had paid travel agents for the opportunity to work abroad, believing that they had secured jobs in Kuwait. They left their homes only to end up at the Baghdad airport and eventually a U.S. military base with no passport. The Punjab police have registered cases against the travel agents on charges of money extortion and human trafficking. Meanwhile, similar reports have led the U.S. State Department to investigate alleged abuses of workers who are part of this troubling pipeline used to deliver thousands of Asians to U.S. military bases in Iraq.
An article published last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association asserts that gifts from pharmaceutical companies to doctors are having a negative effect on the quality of health care in the United States. According to the article, the gifts, which include free drug samples, classes, and lucrative consulting contracts, undermine medical care, hurt patients, and should be banned. Despite the findings, one of the article's authors, Dr. David Blumenthal of Harvard Medical School, told the New York Times that it was not very likely that many in medicine would listen to the group. This report comes in the wake of a recent article in the New England Journal of Medicine that accused global pharmaceutical giant Merck of withholding crucial safety information about the withdrawn painkiller Vioxx, a charge that Merck denies. Currently, it's illegal under federal law to pay doctors to prescribe drugs or devices, but companies still manage to spend tens of billions of dollars a year currying influence through gifts and consulting arrangements, which are almost entirely unregulated. According to the New York Times, these marketing expenses cost the pharmaceutical industry far more than either research or consumer advertising. Although professional guidelines suggest doctors reject gifts of more than modest value, sanctions against doctors who accept gifts of great value are extremely rare. In a related story, the LA Times reported last week that a drug widely used in heart surgery to control bleeding doubles the risk of kidney damage, forcing an estimated 10,000 patients onto dialysis each year, according to a study from a group calling for surgeons to abandon its use. According to the study, the Bayer Corporation-produced drug, known as aprotinin, also increases the risk of heart attack by 48%, heart failure by 109%, and stroke by 181%. According to the researchers, extensive marketing, not the effectiveness of the drug, were behind its widespread use in recent heart surgeries. The researchers added that the drug was not even needed in most cases because there were two generic drugs that cost a tenth as much and were nearly as good at stopping bleeding, yet produced no increased risk. Bayer, with annual sales of $40 billion, has predicted $606 million in sales this year. But with researchers estimating the negative side effects of the drug topping $1 billion, it's clear that consumers are taking another double whammy from the pharmaceutical giant with yet another failed wonder drug.
The Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, announced Wednesday that it was asking all U.S. companies to virtually eliminate public exposure to PFOA. PFOA is a toxic chemical used to make Teflon cookware as well as many other products. This request comes just 1 month after the EPA fined DuPont $16.5 million for hiding data on the toxicity and health effects of PFOA and for contaminating the water supply in the Ohio River Valley. DuPont is accused of hiding this data for 20 years. It was the largest administrative fine in EPA history. DuPont has already pledged to reduce PFOA emissions from plants 98% by 2007. They claim to have already developed an emissions-controlling technology that will allow for this transition and have pledged to share this technology at no cost with competitors. The eight major companies that use PFOA in their products are expected to comply with this request, cutting these toxic emissions by 95% over the next 4 years. PFOA has been found to cause liver cancer, reduce birth weight, and cause immune suppression and developmental problems in laboratory animals. While PFOA is used in the production of many products, most of these products do not contain any PFOA after manufacture.
On January 23rd, Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels asked state lawmakers to accept a $3.85 billion bid from a Spanish-Australian consortium to lease and operate an Indiana toll road for 75 years. Governor Daniels was quoted by the Associated Press as saying that construction on U.S. 31 will begin as fast and legally and humanly possible. The governor's goal is to use the money from the bid to build up to 130 more transportation projects across the state. Democratic House Minority Leader Patrick Bauer went on the record to oppose the leasing of the toll road, saying the state should not sell off its assets. He balked at the plan, dubbed major moves by the governor, saying that it should be called risky business instead. Under the terms of the agreement, the Madrid and Sydney-based consortium would be allowed to raise tolls for cars and trucks that travel the full length of the road from $4.65 to $8 until 2010, when the consortium, known as Statewide Mobility Partners, could raise them again. The legislation is expected to pass the State House to the Senate next week. Just days before the inauguration of Bolivia's new indigenous president, Evo Morales, Bechtel, a global engineering and construction company based in San Francisco, reached an agreement with the government of Bolivia, dropping a legal demand for $50 million. This money was sought to offset damages and profit losses suffered by the company after a revolt over privatizing water services in the city of Cochabamba forced Bechtel out of Bolivia in April 2000. In 1997, the World Bank made privatization of the public water system of Bolivia's third-largest city, Cochabamba, a condition of the country receiving further aid for water development. This led to a no-bid 40-year concession granted to Aguas del Tunari, Bechtel's Bolivian company. Within weeks of taking control of the city's water, Aguas del Tunari rose water rates by more than 50%. The new prices were met with fierce resistance, shutting down the city of Cochabamba on three separate occasions. The violence led to a state of martial law, but eventually Bechtel was forced to leave the country, and the water company was returned to public ownership. The retraction of Bechtel's suit is seen as a huge victory by citizen groups in 43 nations who had participated in the campaign against it.
Earlier this week, Ford Motor Company, the nation's second largest automaker, announced plans to slash up to 30,000 jobs and close 14 plants in North America over the next 6 years. This announcement comes despite the fact that Ford claimed an overall profit of $2 billion in 2005. One day after Ford's announcement, Daimler Chrysler CEO Dieter Zetsche announced plans to eliminate 6,000 management jobs, or 20% of the administration staff, saving his company 1.5 billion euros annually. Daimler Chrysler also plans to cut 8,500 manufacturing jobs in its German plants. In 2004, Daimler Chrysler reached an agreement with Mercedes workers in Germany to increase working hours, slow pay increases, and save the carmaker about 50 million euros annually. In exchange, Daimler Chrysler agreed not to fire workers until 2012.
Competition from China forced the closure of 51 textile and garment factories in Guatemala last year and left some 38,000 workers jobless, according to the Guatemalan Textile Association, Vestex. Vestex manager Carla Caballeros told reporters that the closure of assembly plants, or maquilas, is due to the expansion of similar enterprises in China. The dwindling of overseas contracts at these plants has led to the firing of a total of 24,000 employees, including those of Comarosa, while the permanent shutdown of 51 factories left another 13,000 out of work. The rise of Chinese competition in this sector is due to a 1994 agreement in the World Trade Organization to end the system of worldwide quotas that guaranteed developing countries a specified share of the lucrative textile markets in the United States and Europe. The phase-out was given 10 years to take hold, ending the quota system on January 1, 2005. Without the quotas, in the first quarter of 2005, Chinese textile exports soared. The U.S. quickly imposed safeguard quotas on seven categories of Chinese textiles, with Europe soon following with similar safeguards. According to the Asian Tribune, about 10,000 jobs have been slashed so far in Sri Lankan garment factories since the end of the international quota system in 2005. Recently, a survey conducted by the Workers' Welfare Center found that 60 garment factories out of a total of 735 have closed totally or partially during the past year.
New Zealand news reports last week also indicate a loss in manufacturing jobs, but here the businesses are blaming the high dollar. Plastic container and brushware maker Click Clack blames high interest rates and the high dollar for its decision to move $3 million of supplier contracts overseas, with the loss of up to 35 or approximately 12% of their jobs among New Zealand suppliers. The click-clack announcement comes as a growing number of New Zealand manufacturers are laying off workers or moving production offshore as they struggle to combat with the effects of the continuing high dollar. Sheepskin product manufacturer J.L. Bowron, one of Canterbury's largest employers, is cutting 75 out of 350 of their jobs. Rotorua wood paneling factory Pana Home is closing, putting another 112 people out of work. And South Auckland beef jerky manufacturer Jack Lynn's New Zealand will lay off 102 workers, or two-thirds of its workforce. All of the factories blame the high dollar and changes in overseas markets for their loss of business. Those were this week's headlines, and now for the feature. Today, I'm joined by Lotte Carson, Danish journalist with the Copenhagen newspaper Information. Lotte was one of the contributors for CorpWatch's most recent feature story about Maersk, Denmark's biggest company and one of the largest shipping companies in the world, who, up until recently, controlled Iraq's main oil port. Lotte, could you explain the story?
What happened was that Maersk took over Iraq's biggest oil port very soon after the invasion to Baghdad. And the state then tried to run it for a couple of years. And the thing went really badly, and in the end, Maersk pretty much fled the country and was sued by the Iraqi port authorities over their claims on the port.
Why did they get sued?
The strange thing as I started digging into this story is that everyone seems to have complaints with Maersk. Not only the American top officials who participated in the administration in Iraq said that Maersk would never cooperate with them and actually never had a legal contract for the port. And also the Iraqi officials who took over after the Americans could never get Maersk to cooperate. So in the end, what we have is a contract that probably never existed, or a contract that was never legal for this port that Maersk claimed to have a legal right to, given to them by the American Army.
So without a contract, how were they able to do business there?
What we found out when we investigated into this story, which I've co-written with a colleague called Shalari Orfo and another colleague called Usama Al-Hababe, was that, as it turns out, a Maersk employee was placed within the coalition administration in the area where the port is. Now, this is, of course, probably not legal within kind of regulations for occupation authorities that you can actually employ someone who will then work to promote his own company's interests. And in Denmark, what's going on now is that we're trying to get the politicians to explain how this could happen. And so far, we haven't really gotten a satisfying answer.
So if Maersk had their own people at the Coalition Provisional Authority to facilitate deals, how do you view this as a political issue?
It grabbed my interest not only because it's been mysterious to a lot of Danes why we participated in this war, as Denmark has always been a very peaceful country. And Maersk is a totally unique company in Denmark. It's far bigger than any other company in Denmark. It accounts for about 15% of our GNP, and it has immensely strong ties with politicians and the royalty. So Maersk's behavior in Iraq, of course, is an important measure of how Denmark is behaving in Iraq. And when I came across all these complaints about Maersk in Iraq, I realized that this was probably also a story about how Western companies have been behaving in the aftermath of the war. And I think it's a story that raises a lot of important questions about how to act when you're at war for whichever reason. And what came across from several of the sources that I talked to was that this was a company that behaved in an arrogant and aggressive way, and I felt like that was a very important story to tell, because in a situation like that, there isn't much control of the way that business is being done, and I think it's very important for the people whose country has been invaded that someone look after how we as the invading countries have actually been dealing with this country that we took over.
Well, Lotte, thank you very much for writing that article, and thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks very much for having me. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to CorpWatch News. Find out more about these stories and more at www.corpwatch.org. Special thanks goes out to Liam O'Donohue and Brooke Biggs for research assistance, Prothap Chatterjee for editorial support, Stephen Valentino for anchoring. This show featured music by The Art Ensemble of Chicago and Fela Kuti. Email suggestions and comments to cwadmin@corpwatch.org. I'm Sakura Saunders, and thanks for tuning in.